Good to be back with you this morning. We welcome everyone here, and we have visitors. We welcome you as well, and hope that the lesson this morning will benefit all of us. It's a rather lengthy lesson, so I'm breaking it up into two parts. We'll continue the lesson this evening. But the title of our lesson is that the emperor has no clothes. Has anybody ever heard that expression, the emperor has no clothes? Well, when I get into the subject itself, I hope it'll be obvious why I believe the emperor has no clothes. First of all, what does the phrase the emperor has no clothes mean? Well, I did some research on it, and I was kind of shocked to find out where it came from. It actually comes from a fairy tale written by Hans Christian Andersen in 1837. In this tale, there was an emperor, and the emperor was quite vain. He loved to show off his fancy clothing. Well, along come two swindlers to town, and they approach the emperor, and they tell him that they can make him the finest suit of clothes that he's ever seen. So they told the emperor also that these clothes had a very special quality, that they were invisible to anyone that was either stupid or was not fit to be a citizen of his kingdom. Well, you can imagine what actually happened. In reality, the clothes did not exist. So the emperor, when he put on his new clothes, was actually parading around town in his underwear. After all, he looked at it and he said something's not right here in his own mind, but he didn't want to be thought stupid, or he didn't want to be thought a citizen that wasn't fit for his very own kingdom. So around town he walked. Now, no one had the courage to tell the emperor that he didn't have any clothes on. Instead, they praised his magnificent clothing. Everyone realized it was a scam, but everyone was too timid to say so. So the expression, the emperor has no clothes, is often used in political and social situations where there is an obvious truth that's denied by the majority despite readily available evidence to the contrary. This is especially the case when the issue under consideration is proclaimed by those in positions of authority, for example, the scientific community or the media. People are afraid to challenge them. So this morning and this evening, we're going to consider evolution versus creation. How did life begin? The answer to that question has a dramatic impact upon our lives. Knowing the truth about origins is essential because it affects, first of all, our attitudes towards ourselves and the way we treat other people. It affects the value we place on human life. It affects the value we place on morality. It is quite a different world if human beings are the end result of billions of years of chance biochemical reactions versus the result of an intelligent creator who designed us and created us in his image. And I would just urge you to think about Hitler and the Holocaust. The Origin of Species was one of Hitler's favorite books, and he took a lot of his thinking from that book. Knowing the truth about origins is also important because it affects our concept of God. If human beings are the accidental byproduct of random genetic mutations occurring over billions of years, then God is a myth at best and a lie at worst. It's also important because our view of origins has a dramatic impact on our view of the Bible and of Jesus Christ. There can be no middle ground. For example, theistic evolution, if you've heard of that. Theistic evolution basically says, well, God started life, but evolution, as propounded by Darwin and his followers, then took the ball from there, and we have what we have today because of that. Well, Jesus was a young earth creationist. In Mark 10 and verse 6, He says, but from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female, speaking of man. According to evolution or theistic evolution, man didn't come along until billions of years after the beginning. But Jesus said, we were made male and female at the beginning. Matthew 19 and verse 4 says essentially the same thing. Furthermore, in John chapter 5 and verse 46, Jesus is criticizing the Pharisees and so forth. And he says, for if you believe Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But if you do not believe his writings, how shall you believe my words? So Jesus believed in Moses' writings. And of course, Moses wrote Genesis chapter 1 and 2. Well, knowing the truth about our origins is also essential because it affects people's attitudes towards Christians, towards the Bible, and towards science. I don't know if you're aware of it, but just recently, I believe it was on February the 4th or 6th, something like that, there was a debate between an evolutionist, Bill Nye, the science guy, if you've ever seen him on TV, which I think he's quite entertaining, actually, and Ken Ham, who is the director of Answers in Genesis, which is down in Kentucky, I believe. Well, I'm very interested in the topic anyway, and I watched the debate. And I also got online, kind of this way sometimes, self-abuse. And I got on a website that was pro-evolution. And I want you to see what some of these people think of you and I. These are just some comments that I gleaned from one website. A guy with the handle of Art Carnage said, Nye's only problem may be that he will be running into a deeper level of stupid than he's unaccustomed to. After all, he's used to answering questions from children. That's what people think of you and I. James M. said, he is about to run into a supermassive black hole of stupid from which no logic or reason can escape. A guy with a French name that I can't pronounce said, Nye shouldn't waste his time giving Ham scientific facts. Ham and the crowd we can expect, you and I, simply doesn't speak that language. James M. said, there is absolutely no, and I mean no evidence to support creationism. That's a pretty bold claim. Get this straight, the Bible is not evidence. No more than the Lord of the Rings is evidence of dragons, elves, and hobbits. No more than War of the Worlds is proof of life on Mars. There is no scientific verifiable evidence in the geological, fossil, or climatic astronomical records to back up any claims made by creationists. The Earth is old, tremendously old. We'll address that. Steve P. said, agree 100%. Trying to debate those people is like trying to smell the color nine. Well, that's kind of humorous, but pretty degrading. They are willfully ignorant. At least kids may honestly not know better. Ray J. said, it is legitimizing stupidity. Aaron Booth writes, I almost fell out of my chair at work laughing when I read evidence for creation. Ray J. comes in again and says, only in this country do we waste monumental amounts of time on stupidity like this. Robert said, debating a creationist is just so demeaning. Then another one said, the debate is pointless. People that believe in creationism think in Twitter-like sound bites. Nye won't be able to hold their attention long enough to get these things in their head. Well, one final group here. Andrew J. says, I don't blame Nye in the least. Putting a light on ignorance is the only way to combat it. It is true that creationists get a platform to spout their dogma, but on the other hand, they also have a real chance to be shown as the charlatans they are to those who are in doubt. So I bet you didn't even know that you hired a charlatan for a preacher because in creation. Harry Potter says, this will not be a debate. A debate is between two opposing opinions. This is between scientific fact and unscientific stupidity. Well, we need to be ready to give an answer. That's what Peter said in 1 Peter 3 and verse 15. Opponents of creationism, opponents of God, opponents of the Bible, can be very condescending and intimidating. They will falsely accuse creationists as being unscientific. And by the way, I have 9 journal articles, scientific journal articles that I'm first author on, so I'm not an unscientific person. And I have probably 3 times that amount that I'm at least the second or third author on. But that's the way they'll treat us. They'll treat us as believing in old wives' tales. They'll put us on the same level as people that believe in the flat earth, or on par with those who persecuted Galileo or Copernicus. So we need to properly arm ourselves with the facts. And we can give more than an adequate answer. True science supports creationism much more than it does evolution. We don't have any reason to be afraid if we arm ourselves with the facts. Well, let's define the theory of evolution. In 1859, Darwin published his famous book, The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, which many people think is really the beginning of the theory of evolution, but it's not. This theory goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks, who believed in a form of evolution. But Darwin published his book in 1859. It came out several years after he went on a 5-year voyage as the naturalist on the sailing vessel, the Beagle. They went around, and as he traveled around the world, he came up with this theory and then wrote it down. It's interesting when you study Darwin that he was originally trained at Cambridge University as a minister in the Church of England, but somewhere along the line, he lost his faith. This is a quote from his book. He says, "The Old Testament, from its manifestly false history of the earth, was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus or the beliefs of any barbarian. The New Testament is a damnable doctrine. I can hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity to be true." So I think it's pretty obvious that Darwin shows his bias towards God and towards the Bible. But anyway, the world rapidly accepted, for the most part, the theory of evolution after the publication of this book. In fact, I did a little recent research. If you look up online, and you'll see that, and these are statistics for the United States, that the majority of people believe in the theory of evolution. They believe that explains the origin of life on Earth. The general public is approximately at a 69% level of belief, and scientists at about 87%. I would just point out that it's been my experience over the years that the majority are usually wrong. So that's not a universal truth, but I think it's certainly applicable here. Well, what does the theory of evolution state according to Darwin? It says that all life on Earth arose randomly and spontaneous from non-living matter billions of years ago. TOE, by the way, is my acronym for theory of evolution, because it gets kind of long spelling that out all the time. And I mean no sarcasm by the fact that it's TOE. That's just what it works out to be. Well, theory of evolution adherents believe that the universe is about 13.8 billion years old, and the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. The process of evolution, according to them, first produced common biological molecules like amino acids, proteins, sugars, DNA, RNA, on down the line, from the so-called primordial soup that they say existed on Earth millions and millions and millions of years ago. And then somehow, through random and spontaneous interaction of these molecules, the first one-celled creatures were formed, which, by the way, and this is very important, requires the spontaneous generation of life. Non-living somehow turned into that which was living. Then over millions and millions of years, these one-celled creatures eventually evolved into every form of life that has ever existed on the face of the earth. So it truly is the molecules to man theory. The most egregious error of evolution in my studies is what I call extreme extrapolation. That's certainly what Darwin himself was guilty of. For example, he went to the Galapagos Islands and studied the finches and saw, you know, different shapes of beaks and all of this sort of thing. And then he just jumped to a major conclusion that because of this change in these finches, that this whole crazy theory that he came up with from the spontaneous generation of life, molecules to man, was true. And that is a major jumping to conclusions in my estimation. Well, evolution has four pillars, based on four pillars. The first pillar is all of these have to be true in order for evolution to have even a fighting chance. The first of these, as I've already mentioned, is spontaneous generation. So this means that at some point or points in the far distant past, life randomly and spontaneously arose from dead, inanimate chemicals. Supporters of evolution are fond of theorizing, again, of billions of years ago on the primitive Earth, there existed this primordial soup of such chemicals. And this presented the conditions for the production of the carbon-based molecules that life depend on. And then through some unknown processes that they are at a failure to explain, these randomly produced molecules were able, without intelligence, mind you, to organize themselves into the first one-celled creatures. And amazingly, this had to have happened many times over because these chemicals, these so-called cells, lived in a very, very difficult environment. So I can't imagine that the very first time that it happened, which it didn't happen, was successful. It would have had to have happened over and over and over again to have been successful. But eventually, according to them, it was a success. These cells were somehow able to protect themselves, to grow, to prosper, to reproduce, and then to change over time into every living plant and animal that's ever existed on Earth. So that is a key point in evolution. Second key point is evolution depends on random mutations. To understand this pillar of evolution, we need to know a little bit about the molecule called DNA. And I'm not going to give a huge chemistry lesson here, but just show you a picture of this molecule. It's quite an elegant complex molecule. But DNA is the molecule that's common to all life and contains the blueprint for life. Everything that we are, from the color of our eyes and hair to the proteins that make up our body and so forth, is dependent upon this molecule. It contains the code that's required for every cell to produce every molecule that it requires for life, to reproduce and so forth. Now, I will grant that under various circumstances, minor changes can take place to DNA. And these changes are called mutations. There's no doubt about that. Most mutations occur when a creature's genetic code is being copied at the time of reproduction. And there's also various environmental toxins, for example, certain types of radiation or chemicals that can produce mutations. For example, ultraviolet light from the sun causes mutations in our skin that causes skin cancer. When I was an undergrad, I had to take a course in genetics, and we had this wonderful laboratory where we bred fruit flies, which is no fun. But fruit flies have a whole host of mutations in their DNA. And by breeding these fruit flies, you can learn the laws of genetics. But, you know, in breeding probably 50 or 60 generations of fruit flies, out of my lab tray, I never saw a cat or a dog appear. There was always fruit flies there. Okay? Well, the next pillar of... Excuse me, my wireless is wanting to interfere. Is the idea of natural selection. This concept's almost always referred to as the survival of the fittest. According to evolutionists, stronger creatures survive and weaker creatures die off and become extinct. So the survival of the fittest states that harmful random mutations result in weaker creatures. Therefore, their ability to reproduce and survive is low. But on the other hand, helpful mutations make a creature stronger and enhance their ability to reproduce and survive. So they have a competitive advantage. But I'll show in the course of this lesson that almost all mutations are damaging. They don't produce healthier organisms. And then the fourth pillar of evolution is time. For evolution to be true, an amazing multitude of helpful random mutations are necessary to change a creature into an entirely new species. If random mutations are the key to evolution's success, then time, and I mean lots and lots of time, is required. Imagine how much time would be required for random mutations to build up and produce an elephant from a bacterium. It would be staggering to think of how long that would take and how many mutations that would require. Well, how do we go about evaluating the evidence? How does one decide which better explains the origin of life, evolution or creation? Well, I think there's a couple of things that we need to consider first. The best way to prove any theory as a scientist is to observe the subjects of that theory in action. And this is called empirical science. For example, when I went to graduate school, I was an empirical scientist. We would conduct experiments and evaluate the data collected from those experiments to make certain conclusions. And I'll put it very simply. I'll put it in a dairy cow example for us. I like dairy cows. I worked with dairy cows. Even though I wasn't a nutritionist, I'll use a nutrition example. For example, how do we decide whether diet A or diet B makes dairy cows give more milk? I mean, that's an important consideration for scientists and especially for dairy farmers. Well, we have to observe dairy cows in action. So we have to feed those dairy cows diets A and diets B. And that sounds very simple, but it actually is very complicated because there are all kinds of competing factors, confounding factors, if you will, that we have to control for in order to be able to absolutely measure the difference between those two diets. For example, dairy cows are various and sundry ages. So we have to be very careful we don't bias our experiment by putting all the young cows in one group and all the older cows in the other. Dairy also differ in how much milk they give during what's called the stage of lactation. In order for a cow to give milk, a cow has to have a calf. Once the cow has the calf, milk production starts increasing for a while, then gradually starts decreasing. Well, we could easily bias our experiment by putting all of the late lactation cows into one group and all of the early lactation cows into the other group. So there are techniques for doing those types of things. But the important thing is that we are collecting data that we directly observe from the objects that we're interested in. So direct observation and collection of data from the subjects under investigation is empirical science. And empirical science is used every day. We want to know whether a new cancer drug works. Well, doctors will design a clinical trial, and they'll test the drug on the subjects with cancer and so forth. So that's empirical science. But this introduces a very big problem. Evolution and creation can neither be directly observed. Creation happened at least 6,000 years ago, and we don't have a time machine to jump into and go back to the beginning and view and test what took place. Evolution is also outside the bounds of empirical science. It occurred, if it occurred, millions and millions of years ago. It began its process. Therefore, we can't use directly empirical science to test either theory. But we can evaluate both creation and evolution indirect using empirical methods. For example, we might test rocks and try to figure out how old the rocks are, things of that nature. So that method is called historical science. Now, when arguing with an evolutionist, they just hate it when you separate it into empirical science and historical science. But that is indeed the truth. I would compare historical science to what a detective does. A detective very rarely witnesses the crime. The detective has to go to the crime scene and collect evidence, and that evidence hopefully will lead the detective to formulate what they call a theory of the crime, and then hopefully lead them to the right suspect or suspects. So I just want, at the end here, to add a very important note. Who's being unscientific? Evolution creationists. Many people, especially those in the scientific community and in the mass media, look down on creationists. Again, they falsely accuse us of not believing in science. And they heap ridicule upon us and place us in the same category, again, as those people that believe in a flat earth, tooth fairy, or Santa Claus. So a major goal of this lesson, I hopefully will show you that the exact opposite is true. And I'm not apologizing for the Bible. I think the Bible's very important, obviously. But I think the best basis to attack the theory of evolution is on a scientific basis, because it is a poor scientific theory. Now, the title of the lesson is "The Emperor Has No Clothes." And you'll find that throughout this lesson, I use a lot of quotations from evolutionists that they tell you in their guarded moments they think it's a poor theory as well. So I hope you'll notice as we go through that. I think it's also interesting that there were a whole ton of famous scientists who were creationists. Louis Pasteur developed medical microbiology. He developed the germ theory of disease. He developed various vaccinations for rabies and anthrax. He also made a lot of discoveries in chemistry, and he proved, and evolutionists will admit, that spontaneous generation is a non-starter. It's just not true. Gregor Mendel, if you ever take a course in genetics, you'll study a lot about Gregor Mendel. He was I believe, Franciscan friar, and he bred peas, and he was the first one to work out the basic laws of genetics. Then everybody's probably heard of Sir Isaac Newton. We were able to get to the moon and back safely, in great part due to the fuzz that were derived by Sir Isaac. Lord Kelvin did a lot of work in energetics and thermodynamics. If you ever take a course in chemistry, you'll learn about the Kelvin scale of temperature, obviously named for Lord Kelvin. Copernicus developed the heliocentric model of the solar system, the fact that the sun is at the center and not the earth. Johann Kepler was also involved in a lot of astronomical findings. Samuel Morse invented Morse code and developed the commercial use of the telegraph, the first form of mass communication. James Clerk Maxwell was famous for his work in electricity, as was Michael Faraday. Example, Faraday even has a unit of measurement in electricity named after him, so that kind of shows you how famous he was. Joseph Lister developed the science of antiseptic surgery. He was contemporary with Louis Pasteur and applied much of his theories to surgery. So back in the days before Lister, a surgeon was judged by how much dirt was on his apron, and Lister found out that that wasn't the way to go. That was the way to lose patients rather than to save them. A Frenchman named Georges Cuvier, he developed the science of comparative anatomy and vertebrate paleontology. He was very big in fossils and in classifying them, but he didn't succumb to the theory of evolution. He was maintained as a creationist. If you ever take chemistry, a basic chemistry course, you'll learn a lot about a man named Robert Boyle. He is considered by many as the first really modern scientist and did a lot of work in developing the gas laws. So when you work in chemistry and study about gases, you'll learn about Boyle's law. Humphrey Davy, which happened to be worked with Michael Faraday, also worked in thermokinetics. Blaise Pascal, who was a famous French mathematician, developed geometry even more than it was at the time and worked in probability and a lot of other different things. Sir Francis Bacon was considered the father of the scientific method, and otherwise he really developed the empirical science that we so much depend on today. And then a man named Charles Babbage, he invented the first modern computer. It was not an electronic computer, it was a mechanical computer, which to me in a lot of ways shows the man's genius. So what are the tools that we're going to use to evaluate the theory of evolution and creation? There are four tools that I will use. Probability is the first one. Spontaneous generation and random mutations are events for which probabilities can be estimated. Natural selection can also be statistically analyzed. Now think about this. If the theory of evolution is true, we should find that the mathematical probability favoring it should be very reasonable. Now when I was doing experiments, publishing papers, especially in agriculture, if you couldn't prove something with at least a 95% confidence level, then you didn't say that it was likely to happen. And in a lot of things, we had to be at the 99th confidence level. So my point is simply this, if evolution is true, we should find that probability supports that and supports it rather strongly. Next thing we'll use to evaluate the theory of evolution is the Earth's age. Remember, evolution demands the Earth to be millions and millions and millions of years old. So if evolution is true, then we should find abundant evidence that the Earth is at least at 4.5 billion years old. Analysis of the historical evidence for evolution, again, demands a very ancient Earth. Otherwise, there's simply not been enough time for evolution to take place. And then very importantly, we'll use the fossil record as a tool for evaluation. If you think about it, the fossil record in the Earth's outer crust provides us with a natural museum of past life. If evolution is true, the process of random mutation and natural selection would over millions of years have produced a vast array of fossils demonstrating the gradual change of one species into another. For example, there should be abundant evidence of the change from this single-cell bacterium into an elephant. These are called transitional fossils. We would also expect the oldest and deepest layer of fossils to contain the earliest and most primitive forms of life. Then the shallow layers would show a gradual transition from primitive to increasingly more complex forms of life. Then, very importantly, if evolution is true, we would expect new life forms not to appear suddenly and fully developed, but rather appear slowly and with many transitional forms showing increasing levels of complexity. For example, evolution claims that fish came from amphibians and that reptiles turned into birds, and apes turned into men. So there should be literally museums overflowing with the transitional fossils from, for example, amphibians to fish or reptiles to birds. We should expect fossils to be relatively evenly distributed over the habitable regions of the Earth if evolution is true. Okay, then our final tool to examine evolution is evidence of design. It's unassailable that things that show evidence of design demand an intelligence to have produced that design. For example, let's say I took you out to the airport and there was a 747 sitting there on the taxiway. And I said, you know, it's amazing that I threw grenades into a junkyard over a period of years and that's what appeared. You would think I was absolutely crazy, and rightly so. Consider even something like the lowly mousetrap. It demonstrates a property called irreducible complexity. You have the base plate there, the piece of wood. You've got the thing that flips over and actually kills the mouse. You have the thing that holds the cheese. Got a couple of staples there to hold the entire mechanism to that little board. If any one of those pieces, and there's only, what, seven or eight of them, if any one of them are missing, it doesn't work. So, that's important in the evidence of design, this idea of irreducible complexity. And I'm referring you to a book here that I would recommend called Darwin's Black Box. It was written by a man named Michael Behe. He's not a Christian, which is amazing, but he is a biochemist at Lehigh University. And he pokes a lot of holes in the theory of evolution by pointing out just a few systems in the human body that show this property of irreducible complexity. And it's an important concept to consider. Well, let's actually begin evaluating the theory of evolution and creation. First of all, we want to take a look at spontaneous generation. Remember, evolution is molecules to man theory, so it absolutely, at some point in time, requires spontaneous generation to be true, that non-life, without the direction of intelligence, turned into that which was living. How reasonable is the probability that the random collision of dead inanimate chemicals produced all living creatures? How reasonable is that? Well, I want to look, first of all, at protein synthesis. Proteins are chemicals in our bodies. We all eat protein. If we eat a nice ribeye steak, we eat a big slab of protein. But proteins are vital to life. There are structural proteins like our skin, hair, even our bones contain protein. There are physiologically active proteins, our skeletal muscles, our smooth muscles. Hormones like growth hormone and insulin are both protein hormones. Proteins are involved in molecular transport. For example, hemoglobin in our red blood cells transports oxygen to our body. Proteins are involved in metabolism. If you ever take a course in biochemistry, unfortunately, you'll be exposed to a thing called the Krebs cycle and have to memorize it. But it's a whole cycle of various proteins and so forth that interact, that produce energy in the cell. Proteins are involved as enzymes. Without proteins as enzymes, we wouldn't be able to digest our food. That's why pancreatic cancer is so deadly, because that the pancreas produces protein enzymes that digest our food, and when it's full of cancer and doesn't do that anymore, then we starve to death. So there are a lot of other protein functions. For example, in DNA, the replication of DNA, the function of DNA and RNA and so forth involve proteins. It's, you know, you could, if you took a course in biochemistry, you'd probably spend 3 or 4 weeks easily talking about a lot of these things. Well, simple biochemistry lesson. Proteins are made of smaller molecules called amino acids. And this is just a simple diagram. There are 20 naturally occurring amino acids. And in the formation of proteins, our body, DNA directing the whole process, RNA helping it, takes these amino acids and essentially hooks them together just like pearls on a necklace. In the human body, according to my research, the smallest protein contains 44 amino acids, and the largest contains 34,350 of these amino acids. And the sequence of the amino acids is very critical, because many proteins have a very specific three-dimensional structure. And this three-dimensional structure is determined by the individual of these individual properties of these amino acids acting or reacting together that form this three-dimensional structure. And without that structure, then problems ensue. In fact, even one mistake in the amino acid sequence of hemoglobin destroys its good function. If you've ever heard of sickle cell anemia, there's 574 amino acids in hemoglobin. Sickle cell anemia is the result of one mistake, and it's a very debilitating and deadly disease. Okay. Now think about the theory of evolution and how could proteins ever have formed spontaneously and randomly. Let's grant for a moment the evolutionists that, yes, the primordial soup existed and there were all these amino acids in there. Okay, let's consider a very small protein, smaller than even the smallest protein in the human body. We'll only deal with 20 amino acids. How many possible random combinations are there? There are 20 to the 20th power random combinations. That's 104,858 followed by 21 zeros. That's how many different possible combinations you could get with 20 amino acids. And then to make even things worse, and I hesitated a little bit to bring this up, but I think it's really important. The actual odds are worse because of a property known as chirality. Chirality is a fancy word from the Greek that just means hand. Amino acids have a property called handedness. They can exist in two different forms. And the best way to view it is this. I have amino acid that is a right hand, amino acid that's a left hand. They're the same amino acid. But notice that they're non-superimposable. I can't superimpose one hand on the other, but I can this way. And even though they're the same in chemical structure, they demonstrate this idea of handedness. And nature does not like right-handed amino acids in proteins. It only uses left-handed amino acids. So in this primordial soup, if you will, if it existed, there will be an equal number of right-handed and left-handed amino acids of each type. But proteins only use left-handed. So our probability of a random formation of a protein just got at least doubled because of that. And then, what's even more interesting as a sidelight, the nucleotides in DNA and RNA, nature only likes right-handed. So who says God doesn't have a sense of humor? Okay, proteins and protein synthesis are an important aspect of biochemistry in all living things. But there's a lot more. Again, DNA only uses the right-handed versus the left-handed in proteins. DNA also has a tremendous ability to store information. Again, the reproduction and function of every cell in our body, and by the way, we have approximately 100 trillion cells in our body, is controlled by DNA. How much information can DNA store? Well, 1 gram of DNA can store, and Eric would appreciate this, 700 terabytes of data. That's 14,050 gigabyte Blu-ray discs in a droplet of DNA that would fit on the tip of your pinky finger. For the same kind of data on hard drives, you'd need 233 3-terabyte drives weighing a total of 151 kilos. I figured out, based on the hard drive on my laptop, which I have a pretty sizable hard drive, it would take about 2,800 of those hard drives to could store the same amount of information as a droplet of DNA. Well, one information scientist said this. He says, not only is the amount of information in cellular DNA staggering, it is also incredibly compact. We marvel at computer storage disks with ever greater capacity, yet the quantity of information that could be stored in a pinhead's volume of DNA is equivalent to the content of paper books spanning the distance from the Earth to the Moon 500 times, each book being unique from the other. And evolutionists want us to believe that that all came along purely by the random collision of molecules together. But we've only touched the hem of the garment. From proteins and DNA, evolution requires blind chance to produce a multitude of other biochemicals and then assemble them into a functioning living cell. Single-celled organisms are deceptively complex structures. I show this diagram. If you've ever taken a basic course in biology, you've studied the individual cell. Well, the individual cell is a real marvel. It's a veritable manufacturing facility in miniature. In fact, the average human cell is about 10 to the minus 6 meters thick. To get an appreciation for how small that is, it means that you could align 1,000 of them side by side on a human hair. That's how small they are, yet each one of them contains all of these, this fantastic machinery inside. Again, the human body contains about 100 trillion cells. 100 trillion is a hard thing to get your mind around. That's 100,000 billion, to give you an idea how many cells we have. There are about 210 different general types of cells in our bodies, and more than 1,000 subtypes within these 210 general types. I wouldn't want this to happen to me, but if you could disassemble me cell by cell and line up each cell next to the other, it would encircle the Earth 200 times. That's pretty amazing. And again, every cell is a self-contained unit that has all of these subcellular machines inside of it. Let's consider what one molecular biologist says about it. He gives us a way to look at the individual cells. He says, perhaps no other area of modern biology is the challenge posed by the extreme complexity and ingenuity of biological adaptations more apparent than in the fascinating new molecular world of the cell. To grasp the reality of life as it has been revealed by molecular biology, we must magnify a cell 1,000 million times until it's about 12.5 miles in diameter. and resembles a giant airship large enough to cover a great city like London or New York. What would we then see would be an object of unparalleled complexity and adaptive design. On the surface of the cell, we would see millions of openings like the portals of a vast spaceship opening and closing to allow a continual stream of materials to flow in and out. And I'll add a sidelight here. As a master's degree student, I took a year-long course in physiology. We spent 3 weeks at the first semester studying those holes. And those holes are incredibly complex and incredibly important in the function of our various organs and tissues. If we were to enter one of these openings, we would find ourselves in a world of supreme technology, bewildering complexity. Is it really credible that random processes could have constructed a reality, the smallest element of which, a functional protein or gene, is complex beyond our own creative capacities? A reality which is the very antithesis or opposite of chance, which excels in every sense anything produced by the intelligence of man, alongside the level of ingenuity and complexity exhibited by the molecular machinery of life, even our most advanced artifacts appear clumsy. It would be an illusion to think that we were aware of at present as any more than a fraction of the full extent of biological design. And I would just say amen to that, that over the years as I went to graduate school, things never got simpler. They got more complex as we discovered more. In practically every field of fundamental biological research, ever-increasing levels of design and complexity are being revealed at an ever-increasing rate. Now, this man happens to be a creationist, but I want you to notice the whole tone of what he had to say there. And contrast it with this, which comes from evolutionists. It says, whether the earth cooled from mass or condensed out of a cold dust, life could not have existed when the earth was formed 5 billion years ago. It must have originated since. It is not unreasonable to suppose that life originated in a watery soup of pre-biological organic materials and that living organisms arose later by surrounding quantities of these compounds by membranes that made them into cells. This is usually considered the starting point of organic evolution. Isn't it wonderful to have a magic wand and be able to say these things and offer very little evidence for their truthfulness? Well, amazingly, many famous evolutionists recognize the impossibility of life arising spontaneously and randomly from non-life, and they're in agreement that it's nearly impossible to believe in what evolution demands. The top quote is from Dr. Fred Hoyle, in fact, Sir Fred Hoyle. He's passed away now, but he was an astronomer in England. He said this, he says, the likelihood of the formation of life from inanimate matter, he's an evolutionist, by the way, but he says the likelihood of the formation of life from inanimate matter is one to a number with 40,000 noughts or zeros after it. 10 to the 40,000th power. It is big enough to bury Darwin and the whole theory of evolution. There was no primeval soup, neither on this planet nor any other. And if the beginnings of life were not random, they must therefore have been the product of purposeful intelligence. Indeed, the emperor has no clothes. In reading more of what Dr. Hoyle had to say, he goes on to compare the probability of spontaneous generation of life to the probability of 10 to the 50th power blind people, each simultaneously solving Rubik's Cube. That's where he puts it. Then he went on to say, the notion that not only biopolymers, that's the biomolecules, but the operating program of the living cell, DNA and RNA, could be arrived at by chance in a primordial organic soup here on Earth is evidently nonsense of the highest order. This from an evolutionist. Other famous evolutionists agree with Fred Hoyle, but at the same time, they won't drop the theory. Dr. Harold Morowitz, he was a biophysicist at Yale. He actually testified in the McLean versus Arkansas trial that determined that creationism has no scientific basis. But I want you to notice what he says about evolution. He says the probability for the chance of formation of the smallest, simplest form of living organisms known is 1 to 10 to the 340,000th power. So he even puts it even more remote than Dr. Hoyle. He says the size of this figure is truly staggering, since there are only supposed to be approximately 10 to the 80th power electrons in the entire universe. I'm sure most of you have heard of Carl Sagan. He had a famous show on public TV called Cosmos. He even put the odds of spontaneous generation higher at 10 to the 2 billionth power. Yeah, what did he teach in that program Cosmos? He taught evolution. Well, there's a fellow by the name of Dr. Emil Borel, who is known as the father of modern probability. And Dr. Borel stated this. He said the occurrence of any event where the chances are beyond 10 to the 50th power, which is a much, much smaller number than either 10 to the 40,000th power or 10 to the 2 millionth power. He says any event that has the likelihood of occurring of 10 to the 50th power is an event that we can state with absolute certainty will never happen, no matter how much time is allotted and no matter how many conceivable opportunities are given. The event will just not take place. So despite the insurmountable odds, evolutionists desperately hold on to their theory. So the question becomes why? And I think this quotation here explains it all. This is a quotation from Dr. George Wald. He also has passed away, but he was a professor at Harvard and received the Nobel Prize in Physiology in 1967 for his work in the biochemistry of human vision. He says this: there are only two possible explanations as to how life arose, spontaneous generation arising to evolution, or a supernatural creative act of God. There's no other possibility. Spontaneous generation was scientifically disproved 120 years ago by Louis Pasteur and others. But that just leaves us with only one other possibility, that life came as a supernatural act of creation by God. Now notice, but I can't accept that philosophy. Why can't you accept it? Because I do not want to believe in God. Therefore, I choose to believe that which I know, and this is important, is scientifically impossible. Spontaneous generation leading to evolution. And I can only say one thing about that: that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them or to them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Evolutionists will not let go of the theory simply because they won't believe in God. They'll reject the scientific evidence and call us unscientific for believing creationism. There's also plenty of quotes that I gathered that, and I will show one of these later, that even evolutionists in their private moments, they find it sad that evolution is still taught in high school, basic high school and college texts, because they know of all of the holes in the theory, but they don't have the courage to speak out. Well, we'll have to stop there, and Lord willing, we'll pick up tonight and finish this lesson. I know there's been a lot of details and so forth here. I'll be more than willing to make the outline available to you, because I know that's a lot of notes to write down. But I hope that this lesson, at least thus far, shows you why the emperor has no clothes. And we have nothing to be fearful about in combating evolution and proclaiming creationism. If you happen to be here today and you're not a Christian, we would encourage you to be one. There is a God. The God
that we worship created the heavens and the earth. The God that we worship sent his son to die on the cross that we can have the forgiveness of our sins and the hope of eternal life. But in order to obtain that forgiveness, in order to make that hope your hope, you need to become a Christian. If there's anything that we can do to help you, we would ask you to come forward while we stand and sing.